Tim's not that dumb.
Welcome to Geeks Without God with Nick Glover, Tim Wick, and Molly Glover.
We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
This week on Geeks Without God, it's a geeky boner episode. We say some confusing things about body parts and which ones are engorged as we talk about what got us engorged in the first place.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We're geeks, geeks without God.
Welcome to Geeks Without God. I am your host, Nick Glover. I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Molly Glover.
Hello, I am Molly Glover.
Shut up. And Tim Wick.
Hello, I am Tim Wick.
It's not a very sing-song. We've all been replaced by melodic robots.
Strange robots that use different syllables.
Shut up.
Is this our musical episode?
No, this... Well, I'll tell you what it is, Tim. This is our geeky boners episode.
Musical geeky boner episode?
Depends on what gets you hard. This is, for those of you who haven't heard before, a Geeky Boners episode where we talk about the nerdy stuff in our lives that has us aroused in the geeky organs.
Throbbing
nerd.
What are the geeky organs?
Eyes.
The brain.
The eyes and the brain.
Yeah.
The boobs.
My breasts are so geeky.
We all have boobs at this table, and so we are, because we are geeks.
Oh. So let's start with Tim then.
How fortunate I feel.
Yeah. Tim, what has your brain, eyes, and breasts engorged?
Boy, my breasts could not be more excited about the Great British Baking Show.
Yeah.
We've now watched pretty much all of it.
Yeah.
Like even the little holiday episodes.
There's only a little bit we have left, but
And then there's not as much of it on Netflix, but you can find the master classes where Mary Berry and Paul Hollywood get together and show you how to make.
Did you watch those too?
Yeah, we watched those too. So we watch shit tons of cooking shows anyway. But the Great British Baking Show is my favorite just because everybody's so nice.
I know.
You know, the worst thing that they can say to anybody is what a shame. And they say what a shame, and they're like, oh no.
It's just unfortunate. Yeah.
Not a good bake.
Not your day, mate.
Oh, God.
Not your day. Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. And, you know, and Paul Hollywood shakes somebody's hands. You're like, what just happened?
How did the master class, did you learn anything from it? Do you feel like...
Yes, I mean I didn't retain any of it. But, I mean, they do a really good... They're like, if you do this... this is what's going to happen to your dough, and this is how you can tell when your dough is properly proved, and this is how you can tell when this kind of dough is properly.
See, now I definitely need to watch that.
Yeah, I mean, it actually gives you really good information that if you are paying attention and writing shit down, which I wasn't, so
right.
I mean, but I love the fact that like there are episodes where like one baker is like, oh shit, I'm not going to get this done in time, and all the other bakers are like, I'm done. What can I do for you?
Yeah.
It's just so amazing.
They help.
They all just chip in.
Everyone wants everyone to do their best.
Yeah. Because
what's the point of beating someone good if they didn't do their best?
Right.
And that's, I totally understand that. Like, the joy to me is lessened in a win when you know that it's because someone else failed really badly. Yeah.
Well, and the way they just all the latest season was the best as far as this is concerned, because pretty much every episode you knew who was going home, or it was and it was great because you'd look at it and there'd be people sitting on either side of the person that you knew was going home, holding their hand,
hugging them,
before it was announced, just holding their hands. It's like, it's going to be okay, and then they go, and then
there's always the surprised faces of the people who didn't get sent home when they're like,
right.
What?
Yeah. I thought it was me for sure. Yeah.
And I mean, I love me some Top Chef. I really do. But there's so much backstabbing in Top Chef, whereas in Great British Bake Off, there is never backstabbing. No. There's never anybody saying, oh, I want this person to do poorly. It's like, I have to do well enough to beat this person because they're so good.
Even aside from the contestants, and I've watched a lot of reality TV. My mother loves it, so I've watched a lot of it with her.
Yeah.
Before I was dating Nick, I watched more of it because it was a novel thing back in the early aughts where reality TV was this thing that was kind of like especially cooking competition shows.
Sure.
But what I am, and I watched a lot of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills with my mother.
Oof.
I feel that the main thing is that there isn't manufactured drama on the Great British Baking Show or the Great British Bake Off, whichever you're watching
baking
at the
show,
time.
Yeah.
Baking Show is the American one, the American imprint of the British show.
Right.
But the there aren't long pauses. They don't go, they don't say like, oh, I'm afraid this bake, it's not very dun 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 commercial break.
Yeah.
And then they come back and they repeat 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Because that's a very American TV thing to do.
Yeah.
And they repeat it in a way that doesn't, that makes it clear they asked the person to do several takes.
Right.
Yeah.
About the thing. And they don't do that in Great British Baking Show.
No.
It's, you don't see multiple takes about the same thing. You don't, they don't go to talking headshots where the people are like, I was in dire straits.
And
my cherry thing had plummeted and I didn't know what I was going to do.
They don't do any of that while the bake's happening. All of the interviews happen post-bake.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And
or
I
it's
like
Paul
that.
Hollywood and Mary Berry or Paul Hollywood and Prue being like, oh, this is very difficult because you need to make sure that your pastry dough is chilled just right.
Yeah.
And that's before they show all the baking.
And then they show a baker making the mistake they just talked about. And you're like, oh, fuck.
Or Paul will be like, you're going to just put those apples in without cooking them. It's like, yeah, aren't you worried about the moisture? No, it's worked before.
Mm.
And you're thinking, oh, man.
Oh, fuck, they're going to have a soggy bottom.
I hope it goes great.
Best is when they warn someone about something, like putting cocoa in the dough so they can't tell the doneness by the color.
Yeah.
And then, like, they pull it off despite, like, the hesitancy or the warning.
I thought you were going to fail, but you totally nailed it.
Yep.
And you're like, oh, that's so great.
Honestly, so much of it, people talk about like, oh, the contestants are nice and they want to help each other. And that's true. But such a big part of it is the editing and the way that the show is put together,
mm-hmm.
that they don't try to stretch things out.
Well, and what they do in American reality shows. And I mean, I accept it. Like I say, I love me some Top Chef. But what they'll do is, I mean, they've got these people that are filming the questions or filming the talking head portions.
Talking head parts,
and they're asking leading questions to get people to be bitchy. You know, what annoys you about Molly?
Yeah.
You know, and you're so used to answering these questions, you don't think, you know, I'm going to say something that I'm going to regret later, mm-hmm. because really I like Molly a lot. And I can preface it. I can say, you know, let me tell you 20 things I like about Molly because I think she's amazing. But if you want to know the one thing that annoys me, it's this one thing that kind of gets on my nerves. And that now you take
that.
That's
all they show.
That's all they show.
Yep. Yep.
And you look like an asshole.
It's also really interesting to me because the show has evolved. So they put out this Great British Baking Show, The Beginnings, which was like the very first season of the BBC show or one of the early seasons, so that back before they used to do a lot more history stuff. And so, like, they would send one of the hosts to a factory where they make madeleines. And, like this is the factory in Britain that's made them the longest. And, like, how many can they make an hour? And when
this
and, like,
eel pie shop has been running for 150 years.
I know, that's
eels
pretty cool.
Eels were used because they were easily fished out of the Thames. And they were a savory meal. And, like, all this good history stuff that has since gone by the wayside, and some people don't like that, but I like that they haven't injected anything else. Like, what they've done is they've removed the history stuff to give more time to the people who are doing the baking, which is great.
And they haven't Americanized it as it's become popular in America.
No.
And I appreciate that. And I know we got to
get brought on Noel Fielding, which is like the most British thing you can do to an episode.
I mean, besides like Doctor Who or something.
I'm not nuts about Noel. And the only
I love Noel.
I know the only reason I'm not nuts about him, he's fine, but it's just that the way he says "on your marks, get set, bake" is always exactly the same.
Mm.
It's set, bake.
Have you watched The Mighty Boosh?
Like, he's got to change it a little bit. No.
You've seen IT Crowd.
Yeah, I have seen IT Crowd.
So The Mighty Boosh, I think he did after? Before. The Mighty Boosh is his created thing with his comedy partner.
Noel Fielding is the wacky guy, and the other guy is the straight man, and true to form, neither of us can ever remember the other guy's name.
Yeah, his character's name is Howard Moon, I know that.
Yep.
But it's and so we were so tickled that he was going to be on, because he's been long been a favorite of ours.
Yeah.
And he's brought a wackiness to the hosting that I very much appreciate.
The costumes. And
and he hasn't dialed himself back.
No, just surreal.
That's not the part. Honestly, it is literally just the way he says
bake. Ready, set,
bake. Bake. Yeah. It's the same every time. And I'm like, dude, mix it up. Come on.
I've heard that I don't know about the current hosts, but the previous hosts, I heard that they used to do some very sweet stuff for contestants when they would be like, kind of demolished and crying or whatever, the previous hosts would stand in plain view or earshot of the person crying and start swearing and saying inappropriate things to soil the footage so they couldn't use it in the show.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And they'd do things like block and stand in the way of shots to, like, give people a little bit of room to be emotional and stuff.
And swearing, like, sailors and all
of
that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's nice.
So it's a really, really sweet sentiment that kind of goes to the
core of why that show is really kind of cool.
I think so.
And I know we got to get to other boners. The other thing that I love about it is the only prize is a fucking crystal cake plate.
Yeah.
There's no money. There's no job.
No,
it's not
car.
Like
there's no advertising. It's not a crystal cake plate brought to you by, you know,
It's just like, here's your cake plate. Congratulations.
It's an honor. Like, literally, that's all it is an honor.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's great. Anyway, it's a great show. And
it is.
That's my boner.
Even if you hate reality TV. Yeah. Hey, Molly.
Yes.
What's doing it for you?
So here's the thing. My boner directly docks with Tim's.
Ominous.
Look it up, kids. Just Google docking boners. I'm sure you'll find something great.
Yeah,
so,
man.
Nick and I are terrible about waiting to give each other Christmas gifts.
Oh, yeah.
The main reason...
Not waiting about... opening them, but waiting about giving them.
We both espouse the sentiment that we are very excited for the other to have the gift. We tend to give each other gifts that are, you know, practical, usable. And why if it's here and it's wrapped, why wait another 3 weeks to give you a gift when here it is? And
you can be using it right now. We have it
so,
in the house.
We gave each other our Christmas gifts, and Nick got me a KitchenAid stand mixer.
Oh.
Because of my delightful love and appreciation for Great British Baking Show. And so I decided to give it its inaugural spin and make a bread.
Its inaugural spin.
Yeah. Make a bread that had a simple recipe but a complicated making. So I made a... I might have been a little drunk one night while we were watching Great British Baking Show, and I ordered off Amazon the Great British Bake Off Cookbook.
See, I think you could have done that sober and it would still be okay.
You'd think so, but what was funny was I was drunk, and so then when it arrived in 2 days, I was like, oh, drunk Molly, gift for sober Molly. Thank you, friend. So... I have been wanting to make things out of this book, but, you know, a lot of them require, like, either hand kneading or a lot of stuff that I'm not familiar with. And one of my goals for this next year is to learn how to bake properly.
Okay.
I used the stand mixer and I made a recipe from the book called Greek Country Bread, which is very simple dough, just two kinds of flour, yeast, and water. That's it. And made a nice, like, wheat dough, and
no
then
egg.
Nope. And then what you do is you take the dough and you let it, you prove it, you let it rise. And so I did all that. And then you divide it into four. And then those four bits are rolled out into 35 centimeter sized sheets. And then each sheet is sprinkled with, is brushed with olive oil and sprinkled with toasted crushed walnuts and then layered all together. So you have four layered sheets. You roll it like a Swiss roll and then you coil it up. And it looks like a very nice poop. And especially if
it
you
looks
don't,
like a very fancy poop.
I didn't flatten it.
I saw pictures.
You
it
did.
Does look like a poop.
I didn't
yeah.
flatten it enough, so it looked extra poop-like. But that was the one thing I didn't do properly, was I didn't push it down hard enough. But the bread was amazing. It was it was perfectly proved and perfectly baked. It passed the thumbprint spring test. It had a nice, like, nice good bottom. And I took it out and I tapped it to see if it was hollow. Mm. You want to tap your bottom and hear a nice hollow. Hollow Sound.
Check your bottom.
It was great. And so now my next goal is to make puff pastry, which nice. I have watched many times, and I am very confident I know how to make. So, also...
Rough puff or regular puff?
So I think I'm going to try rough puff first.
Sure, it's easier.
It's easier. And then move on to the full sheet butter puff. we did some organization to try to make it so we had more space in our kitchen because we are a typical Minnesotan kitchen where the majority of counter space is taken up with clutter. You know, and
I don't
then
know
you,
what you're talking about.
I know. And I was just upstairs. And the majority of the majority of your meals are cooked on a 2x2 square that you've cleared yeah. off. Even
the clean
you have,
spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But beyond
when the,
that.
When the oven isn't on, that's just another shelf.
Yes. And now that we have a dog, please see back to previous puppy boners.
Gross.
Soon she'll be able to be in the kitchen cleaning up all my drop bits, which is nice because one of the things that was sad about when Ayn died was I realized I now have to pick up stuff off the floor like a fucking plebe because I don't have a dog to just eat it off the floor for me. Yeah. So now I have the rightful order has been restored. I do not have to pick things up off the floor. The dog is there.
The only thing that doesn't sound good about that bread is walnuts because I hate them.
You don't like walnuts?
You could substitute.
Yeah.
It's
oh,
so
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
It's so
yeah.
I love nutty.
Pecans.
I like pecans. I like pretty
work.
Much every nut except walnuts.
Is it the bitterness?
They're bitter yeah,
they're
have
bitter
a dusty flavor.
And there's a squeakiness to them that I just don't,
yeah.
I don't know. Walnuts, I can't.
Yeah.
The bread is super good. I love nutty bread, like something with a good crunchy
I like seedy
chewy.
Bread, like
yeah.
bread
yeah.
Stuff,
oh, yeah.
like
yeah.
seeds like on the top and even inside.
No doubt.
You could also make this very easily with sunflower seeds
oh,
or
sure.
anything else.
Yeah, I know you could. I have
yeah.
a guess as well.
Yeah.
Everything but the walnuts sounds good.
Yeah. In any event, it was really successful and I'm very excited to make more. I also, and I think when this goes up, this will already have happened, but I'm going to be the expert in the Great Strike Theater Improvised Bake Off.
This is their second one, isn't it?
Yes, which yeah. is which is the Strike Theater is a local place, new theater that does all kinds of great stuff. They do storytelling and improv and sketch, and they started this, friend of the show, Eric Knight, was in it last time in the spring.
He was a contestant.
He was a baker. Yep.
Yeah.
So
he had a bad Scottish accent
for about half a second, and then he dropped it. It was great. It was
it
great.
Was lovely.
It was really funny.
It was entertaining.
But
not
so
a diss.
They want us to do characters. So I have decided that because I have blue eyes and I am the expert, therefore you know one of the judges, I am Mall London.
Ah.
As opposed to Paul Hollywood.
I got it. I got
yeah,
it.
Yeah. So. But it'll be really fun. I get to do improv with Shannon Custer and Rita Bozma, which is like dream
it's
team.
Be badass.
I am so ready. It's gonna be great. So I have been steeping in baking. So you choosing baking show was perfectly serendipitous with our boners. Our boners combined. Shing.
They do dock.
Shape of
boner.
Shape of an erect penis.
Size of a mushroom.
Oof.
Yes. All right. Nick, please save us from this poorly timed comedic joke and tell us about your throbbing tumescent breasts.
Breast oh, boner.
So I have two because they're both short.
Can I get a high five? Can I get a high five for these two short boners? Thank you. Those are my short boners.
Like a Klingon.
Yeah.
They're like two breasts.
So,
yeah.
They're like nipple boners.
This past week at a video game award show, they debuted a whole shitload of trailers for upcoming games. And they debuted the trailer for this game called The Outer Worlds, which is by Obsidian. Now, in the trailer itself, the way they pitch it is, from the creators of the original two Fallout games and the developers of Fallout New Vegas, which is kind of a way of saying from the people responsible for the good Fallout games, in a way. Not everyone agrees with that. I liked Fallout 3. I liked Fallout 4. But my favorite are the first two, and New Vegas
right.
is great. So it takes place in space. It is first person. There's a lot of role-playing aspects.
It looks pretty cool.
It looks funny and lighthearted the way Fallout was, like, not super serious and dark. Like, companions can abandon you. You can kill important characters that are necessary to the plot. Like, you can be totally evil, totally good, anything in between, a complete mercenary. Full consequences for all your actions and lots of choice and decision. it's basically like what you look for in like a Fallout 3, 4, New Vegas type first
person shooter. Nick, were any of these people involved in making Mass Effect 3?
None.
Weird.
Yeah. But it is getting compared to Mass Effect in that there's the player choice stuff.
And your choices matter.
And it is in space.
But not Mass Effect 3.
But unlike Mass Effect 3, the choices will matter. So, it looks really great. I recommend going and looking at the trailer. If first-person shooters aren't your thing, that is unfortunate because every other aspect looks fucking amazing.
Hi, friends. I'm here for you and your inability to play first-person shooters.
But it's not a game that's coming out soon, and it's not a game I'm playing, so the B part to my boner,
buzz,
boner B,
is a little over a week ago, I started something called Bullet Journal, which is kind of like...
Your Bujo?
Oh, yeah, that's what they call it, the Bujo. it is a dotted journal where you are just taking blank pages and you are adding an index and setting up your calendar and your future stuff and organizing all your daily tasks. And it kind of entirely relies upon you to make this planner as your days occur.
And you were inspired because a friend of the show, Bill Steitler,
yeah,
had posted about how it was really working for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he posted some pictures of his journal, and I was pretty intrigued, and I started looking into it, because I'm not a super organized person in a lot of ways.
What?
Right. And I got it, like, and I don't, I mean, it's only been like a week and a few days, but I like it. I'm kind of taken to it. And they say the real test is once you're done with your first month, you take all your tasks and a bunch of information from the previous month and you kind of pick and choose what you migrate to the next month. And I guess that's where people say it starts to click. And so I'm not to that point yet. I'm just to the part where I've got December, I've got my weeks and my days, and I like it. And it's fun because my handwriting's getting a little better. There are all sorts of studies done about how handwriting every day is good for your memory. Even the things that you're not writing, but just in general, doing more handwriting is good for your memory. There are a lot of cognitive benefits to handwriting. And outside of the bullet journal now, like, everything I do is typed either on a phone or on a keyboard.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm writing something down, it's scratching down a shopping list on a Post-it note. But the weird thing about the bullet journal is because you're not filling it out in advance, really, you could have, like, a page that's your daily log for the last 4 days, and then you turn the page, and then the next page is like your meeting notes from a meeting you had, or script ideas, or a movie to watch list of recommendations or something. And then the very next page, your daily journal might pick back up. And it kind of entirely relies upon you to use this index that you create at the very beginning of the journal to outline where everything is. That way, I'm always kind of hesitant to write in like a fancy Moleskine notebook or a journal or something because like things out of order bother me and I want to be able to dedicate some space to things here and there and I want to be able to have some planning to it to the point where I have like analysis paralysis and never end up writing in the fucking thing. With the bullet journal, you're deliberately going against that and going out of order with things and you just have to kind of keep track of where everything is.
I think you'd like it, Tim, honestly, because you're like, I only use it for personal stuff. My work notebooks is too proprietary information. But since your personal life and your work life are so intertwined, as a writer, I think it could really be something that you'd really enjoy.
It actually sounds very interesting.
Yeah, I think I could definitely see you using it to full effect. So feel free to talk to Nick or Steitler about it because I think you'd really enjoy it.
There's a bullet journal book, and a bullet journal branded journal, you need neither to do this. There are YouTube videos from the guy who created the bullet journal method that show you how to do everything. There's tons of resources online to do it. I will say that the bullet journal book does kind of delve into the philosophy of bullet journal, which I'm not super sold on yet. And I have to admit, like with anything that's kind of self-helpy in a way, it does have that kind of like cultishness about it.
Yeah.
Like, bullet journal saved my life and my marriage and, and my job, and now I'm on the moon.
My kid was having a seizure, but instead I pulled out my bullet journal and the paramedic saved his life.
That's like, actually an anecdote from the book.
Literally an anecdote in the book.
Is
wow.
They're able to pull, well, I mean,
it's good.
But they had a collection in their journal, which was all of their kids'
seizure history,
so when they last had
their pages out and was like, here, these are important.
And gave it to the paramedics and it was useful.
Okay.
But in the, but still, it has that kind of like cultish.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Yeah. Not in a bad way, and, just in the like, way of any self-help thing.
And you don't need any of that to use it or to do
it's
it
true.
At all.
It's true.
When it comes to to-do lists and shit like that, I constantly am trying to figure shit out. So, you know, it sounds like something that could be very helpful.
I am a highly organized person who has a career as a highly organized person.
Right.
Like in that meme that goes around that's like, describe your job, you know, in a way that makes it sound ridiculous, I have said, I am a calendar that takes notes, which is very true. That's very true. That's what a project manager does. And that's what a producer for board games really is, like a project manager that's on, you know, I'm on 15 projects at a time. This has helped me organize because I'm able to be really organized at work. But for some reason, when I get home, I'm so tired, I don't want to organize my home life.
Right.
And this has really helped me with that in the sense of like, and also, one of the things that's helped me with is like being able to let go of things that in my brain, I'm like, no, I should be doing this. I should be doing this. And it's like, but you're not gonna. So just let it go and focus on the things that you can do instead of having this constant like, I should be worrying about this. Mm. You know, like, don't worry about it anymore.
I think it's nice. A big part of the book is about taking the time to do the things that are worth taking the time to do. You don't make time for things, you take time for things. And if things aren't worth taking the time for, then why the fuck are you worrying about them? Cross them off your list and find something worth doing. And if you have things you need to do, then you need to do them and you shouldn't cross them off.
And I have a feeling, Tim, you are a lot like me in that you have a lot of things on your list and it's like the list is, and the book is saying, mark the things that are priority. P.S. If everything's a priority, nothing is. So it's it's hard to go through and be like, oh, that's important, that's important, that's important, that's important. It's like, Molly, what's important today?
Right.
What's priority today? Don't prioritize everything. That's a useless list. So it's really helped me with that, especially being like, what do I have to get done today? And if I don't, I'm going to be really upset with myself. Making that just two things.
And I... on my daily stuff, I track that I've taken my antidepressants, that I've taken my vitamin D every 3 days, that
I've got a collection that's tracking whether or not I did my PT. I'm going to try to do my meditation for 100 days in a row. Like,
It's neat. If you're looking into it, my recommendation would be to not look at, like, Pinterest, and because people go all out and will do like crazy art in all their pages where they're erasing dots and using whiteout and markers and stuff. Like, my bullet journal is not fucking fancy. I use a couple different colored pens to color code a few things. That's it.
Yeah.
It's all chicken scratch in there. There are no pretty pictures in it. You don't need that shit. Yep. I did buy a couple of rulers and stencils for doing straight lines, but that's about it.
Yeah.
I really like it so far. We'll see if it sticks, but I'm looking forward to it.
Sounds cool.
With our boners laid bare for all to see.
Everybody sees our booby boners.
Next up is five questions.
Ooh, I have five questions for us to answer.
From whom, Molly?
They're from Ken Larson.
Oh, hey. Ken.
Yes. So Ken asks five questions, and the first one's crazy. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Question one. Is there a God? No, really. Is there a God?
No.
Winky face.
No.
I also say no.
Okay, solve that problem.
Question two. Who is your favorite teacher in school or in life? I will say I feel like I have learned the most from mental illness. Mental illness has been my best teacher. I feel like 9 times out of 10, when someone compliments me on a personality trait, it is something that I have had to learn slash get better at because of mental illness. When people say, oh, you're such a good like listener, or, oh, you give good advice. It's a lot of it is because, yeah, I've had a shit ton of therapy and I speak my mind. You know, I was just talking to a friend of the show, Eric Knight, about this today at lunch, that one of the reasons I have a hard time being like, oh, I need to lose weight, so I'm just going to do that, is I kind of had to switch off my willpower switch to get better from anorexia. And so sometimes I feel like I'm too lazy because I'm afraid I'm going to have to flip it back on. Right. You know, in order to be less lazy. But, you know, honestly, being lazy was something that I needed to learn how to do and to just relax.
Otherwise, and I helped.
Honestly, otherwise I would have burned out by age 25 easy. Like, it's there's a lot of lessons I have learned, and I feel they have all stemmed from mental illness.
Mental illness.
Ask your doctor if mental illness can help you. It can't. Don't have mental illness.
I think because... as a performer, as that being my life, the two people that really influenced me a lot, one was Bill Wallace. He was my college tech teacher.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of things. One of which is he taught me about the meter, which is when you're doing a public presentation, think about how many times you say or ah.
Oh, sure.
To the point that I'm pretty good at not saying it.
Yep.
In just about everything I
podcasts
do.
Podcasts help with that too.
They do, but you can listen to people who do podcasts who say and ah all the time. Because
listen to other podcasts? Blasphemy.
No, I don't do that. But other people might. But the thing is that because he did that, I think about it all the time when I'm talking. And honestly, it helps in everything.
Yeah.
Because it makes it sound like you know what the fuck you're talking about if you're not pausing in that way that everybody expects.
Yep.
He also helped me figure out what I wanted to do with my life, and just he was. Yeah, well, he taught me a lot about a lot of things. But the other person that was a really big influence for me was Gary Parker,
who is
the artistic director of the Renaissance Festival. Basically, in my formative
years,
he's
still out there as the mechanical man.
He's still out there. I mean.
If you've seen a weirdo moving statue guy, like
part of what's amazing is he is. In his 70s, and he still is out on the street, and he works every day, and he performs every day. And if you've ever been, if you've ever done any of the education that he does as far as improv training and living theater training, it's amazing.
Yes.
He's also, I've talked to him when forming stage acts about, he's talked about what other stage acts did and what they learned. And that advice really helped me figure out how to make a stage act that worked.
Yep.
And then also help me watch other stage acts and go, what's not working about this? What can I do that's different?
Mm-hmm.
What is working about this? So those two people were really hugely influential in terms of where I am now.
Excellent. Nick?
A couple of high school teachers. one is Chris Fisher, who was a theater teacher at, I think is maybe, maybe still, theater teacher at Southwest High School, Minneapolis Public Schools, District 1. I think like every theater teacher has to wear one of those like photographer tech vests. Like, I think that's a requirement at some point or another. They have to wear one. And
I went to a private school, so
He had eyebrows that came out like 2 inches. Like,
that
really
sounds like theater teacher.
Really, really aggressive eyebrows. And he had a very liberal policy with the hall pass. But I learned a lot from him in how much he let me slack, and then like was like, guess what? Your failure is your own. Are you gonna do something with this or not?
Got to get the work done.
I kind of had to catch up on my own, get used to that freedom that I wasn't used to. Which was I learned a lot from him. He was the first person that put an H.P. Lovecraft book in my hand as well.
Cool.
So you know, like, hey, you dig this? It's horror. Check it out. The other teacher, Casey Briskin. Oh, that poor woman. I think her first year teaching school was my freshman class, like outside of being a student teacher, I think.
What did she teach?
English. Freshman English.
I am sorry for her.
Yep. At
she's that job is why I didn't complete my master's.
Yeah. I think she had a lot of faith in me, and she put me up for like a bunch of fun extracurricular projects, like with photography and writing and stuff. She saw something and she tried. God bless her little heart for looking at a burnout and being like,
yeah,
he participates. Yeah. There's hope.
I thought there wasn't a God.
Well,
we agreed with
metaphorical God. Goat. God.
Goat.
But like, yeah, she, I think she regularly had classes that ended in her like crying and leaving for mental health because of how awful our class was. And yet like she's still teaching and she's still doing it.
Well, that's
and she's
good.
Still
couldn't
yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah.
I feel like an asshole for not mentioning a human now that you guys both like.
I'm also
gonna
point out that Ken Larson is the person that told me that you play a boron by holding a tipper like a pencil and shaking it like a thermometer.
So, and that was helpful?
Yes.
Well, there you go.
So there you go,
so
Ken.
He was also one of your
you
best
made the
teachers.
List, Ken.
I will give a honorable mention because I realized that it says favorite teacher and the mental illness was definitely not my favorite teacher. So I will give a shout out to Troy Wilhelmson, who was my, in college, was my stagecraft and improv professor who made me realize that you could be in theater and not be a giant fucking dramatic asshole who needed attention all the time. You could just be a regular cool person.
Crazy.
Who just wanted to do theater. All right. Question three from Ken Larson. What is your favorite moment of your performing career?
Jesus.
Gadzooks.
Right? Your favorite moment. And think about those negative ones too, because we got a question coming up in the hopper about that. So.
Oh boy. I know that one already. I'm ready for that one. But
there's a lot of favorite moments I could pick. But since we're talking about teachers,
mm-hmm.
I remember there was Miss Petuzak was my high school Shakespeare teacher.
Gesundheit.
And I took it in ninth grade. I had been acting for a while, but didn't really think it was a thing that I was going to do. And part of the Shakespeare class is we all had to do a monologue, which scared the fuck out of me. Scared the fuck out of me to stand up and do a monologue in front of the class. I'm sure it scared the fuck out of half the other kids in the class,
sure.
At least. And I was near the end, and everybody got pretty much savaged. And I did the opening monologue from Richard III, and I got up and I did it, and I got done. And the first thing that Ms. Petuzak said was, okay, what did he do that made that so good?
That feels good.
I was like,
yeah.
Oh, maybe I can do this.
Nice.
So anyway,
that's great.
There are plenty of moments, but that's the one I'm picking for this question.
Years after I won the amateur show for vilification tennis, we decided to have another cast competition show where a lot of vilifiers were competing against each other initially as two teams, and then, you know, things splintered off in a kind of reality show style. The final two people performing were Eric Thompson and I. Eric Thompson, who also has won the amateur show two years after me, the year after Molly, I think.
The amateur that I coached to the win after my first year being in Vil? That's right.
That's the one.
Yeah. Eric and I had the option of, so there was like a cash prize or like there was money for the winner.
Yeah.
Everybody, all the money
tickets
we made for that show
went
to the winner.
Yep. So Eric and I had an option. We could pick someone to come up and be our partner for this final match against each other, but we'd have to split the winnings with that person.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could just do it ourselves one-on-one.
And I love that you didn't pick me. Knowing that you wouldn't have had to split the money with me.
We had to both agree on the decision. So, I mean, we've been doing Vil all night. We were like...
For two nights. This was a
two-night show.
Yeah, so we were really rough on material and really worn out. And Eric and I just looked at each other and we were like, nah, we'll do this. And Eric and I insulted the hell out of each other. And I ran out of material, straight up was out. And I was ready to lose. And I looked at him and I said this really sweet thing about how I respect him as a friend and as a director, because he's our director for Wise Fools, and as a performer and all that. And then after this really, really sweet thing, I said, you know, but Eric, from all of us, dude, you gotta stop fucking kids. And like, and it got a really big laugh, and like that was it, and that was the end of the show.
Yeah.
And like that was gonna be my, that was meant to be like my concession. Like that was me saying like, you got it, man.
Yeah.
But like I ended up winning off that, and just it was me and him at the end, and we both decided to just do it, the two of us, and how it ended, like it was really, really great.
That was a good show.
Yeah.
My whole team was great. We were the butt pugs.
Yeah, that was a good team. So this is, I think this is my favorite moment in my performing career, just because it is so very Molly. It was back when I was still like kind of like orchestrating Fearless Lab, and I had decided I was going to sing a song with my guitar that I barely knew how to play, and then I forgot my guitar at home, and we still needed to fill that time, and it was Fearless Lab, which means you do it, and it's, you know, you don't. And so I got up, and sans guitar, a cappella sang a song that I had been planning to do, and did it, and nailed it, and it was great. And even though it had pauses and other things, I managed to do like little like dancing wiggles and like like kind of just like make the pauses go. And just the fact that like it, I feel like most people in the world wouldn't get up to sing a song with a guitar they barely knew how to play in general. And most people who would do their first thing definitely wouldn't get up to just sing the song sans guitar they barely knew how to play, you know, and just do it anyway. And for me, that was just a very like, this is who I am and I don't care. And it went well and it was fun.
Cool.
I got a lot of great moments, but I liked that a lot. All right, question four. What is the most embarrassing moment of your performing career?
I don't know about most embarrassing. Certainly one of the most terrible in a very public way, which makes it embarrassing.
Yeah.
We were part of a improv group part of Fearless, and we were paid to perform improv at a bar for a fashion show/ concert called I Am St. Paul.
That was the night our friend? No, that was not the night our friend died. Yes, it was.
It was.
It was the night our friend Bill Young died.
The night Bill Young passed away.
Wow. Yeah.
So we had just found out that a good friend of everyone that was performing had died. And then we went up and did long form improv in front of a full bar that had no interest in improv.
Like negative interest. Like we, backs turned, conversations.
Even with stick mics that we had to hand back and forth.
To do improv, by the way.
To do,
if you've never done improv holding a microphone,
it's the best.
Yeah, I'm sure it's great.
We didn't have a single eye in the house.
Yeah.
We got paid. We had fun.
Yes.
We got to toast our friend afterward. Yes.
It was a bonding moment for sure.
The performing itself was really just fucking worst case scenario.
I would say mine was, I mean, any time that I've just fucking biffed it in Ville, but moreover than that, I was in a show in college called Mother Courage and Her Children, which is a Bertolt Brecht play.
Yeah.
And it's awful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very long, awful play about, I think, the Hundred Years' War.
Yeah.
And therefore has zero interest for anyone. And I think the most embarrassing moment of that for me was getting done with the show. And it was the rare show that my family had finally come to see me be in a play. And afterward, my mom saying, boy, when that third kid died, I was just like, well, the play has got to be over soon, right? And that went on for another hour and you weren't even in it. And it was like, I mean, and earlier that night I had been doing a fight scene where someone was supposed to slap me, but instead of slapping me, she'd boxed my ear.
Oh.
So I was in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, having like the people who mattered to me the most being like, all I could think about was, when is this over?
Yeah.
And it was just one of those like, wow, maybe I just don't want to be in theater situations mm-hmm. that contributed to the 10-year gap I had after quitting Comedy Olympics in 1998. So.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Most embarrassing moment. I've been cycling through a bunch, but
there's lots for everyone.
I finally, there was there was a show that I designed the set for called Thrushbeard in college.
Ooh.
It was my senior project.
Was it called Thrushbeard in college?
It is just Thrushbeard.
Okay, Jesus you were Christ. In college. All right, Thrushbeard.
It was called Thrushbeard.
Okay. Got it.
Outside and, of college, it was called something else.
And I look back at it now and the design was dumb. But anyway, I was happy with it at the time. And part of it was this fairy tale story. So there were the big words in this scroll work of Once Upon a Time on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that happens in the show is that these words are revealed. And one of the words is an A that was stood up. And the A stood up and then it fell right back over again.
Oh, no.
So the first moment of the show, the set that I designed that's my senior project
just falls over. God.
And I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That was the moment that was so embarrassing. Even though I wasn't on stage
and
nobody knew anything.
You knew.
Yeah.
I knew that wasn't supposed to happen.
I once fell off a balcony in rehearsal and landed on my back and had my underwear showing to my entire high school class while the guy I used to date and his new girlfriend came over and were like, are you okay? But that was less embarrassing than like knowing that, you know, while I wasn't even on stage, the play was so bad people wanted to leave. So like, I get it. I feel you.
So there you go.
Yeah. All right. Final question. What is your dream project? Performance or otherwise? I would like to make a highly decorated 3-tiered cake that I like, a wedding cake like that. To me, like, a dream project for me is like to do something I've never done that's so fancy that everyone's like, and everyone loves it and it tastes really good and it's beautiful and it's like days of work and I pull it off flawlessly and it doesn't like get broken on the way to the car or anything like that. That is, I feel like, to me, an easy answer. That is my dream project.
There,
obviously, if I thought about it longer, I could probably come up with something else, but
I would love to, not this house, next house, have a small, like, half-stack cabinet with a nice switch and a good router and some enterprise-level equipment that actually I have a good deal of already. And I'd love to wire up the house with Ethernet jacks and have like a good router and a mesh Wi-Fi network. I would love to take the time and put forth the effort to do what is my profession during the day and be a network engineer and make my house fucking awesome with good punch downs and a breakout board and all that jazz. I would really love to do that sometime.
I just want to write a play somebody else produces. That would be my dream, is to write a play that somebody else wanted to do.
And,
you know, that I got royalties for. Not because of the money, but just because it says, ooh, this thing was good enough somebody else wanted to do
it. Like a Samuel French booklet with your name on it, kind of a thing.
That'd be fucking awesome.
Yeah.
That's where I'm at. That's my thing.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's obtainable.
Thanks for the questions, Ken.
Yeah, well, Ken.
Yeah.
And thanks for telling me how to play a boron. Hey, you know, and then telling me that I had to practice.
Yeah.
Thank you for making Tim practice for real. If you could tell Tim to practice more, that'd be great.
It would help.
I'm just kidding, Tim. We love you and your boron. We are Geeks Without God.
It's true.
If you have answers to Ken's questions, you can leave them in a comment either at geekswithoutgod.com or at us on Facebook, which is, I think, facebook.com/geekswithoutgod. We love your support on Patreon. It's got us these new microphones. It's let us go see some psychics. It bought us a Ouija board for our demon summoning Patreon exclusive episodes.
That now has our blood on it.
It literally has our blood on it.
And some wax.
And some wax.
Waxy blood.
If you want to listen to that episode, you can throw us literally any money and you get to listen to the Patreon exclusive episodes.
I have a correction to make because we answered some questions from a Patreon supporter and I mispronounced their fan approved moniker.
Dum, dum, dum.
It is not Freethinker215. It's not Freethinker215. It is Freethinker215 because of the Philly area code.
Well, there we go.
So sorry, Freethinker215, but you know, like, you can understand the mistake.
In gritty we trust. That's what really matters here.
And thanks for your support on Patreon.
Absolutely.
Freethinker215.
If you're you're a Patreon supporter, you can ask us your five questions and they'll get bumped to the top of the queue, which is great. ask us whatever you want. We'll see what happens. It could be crazy. Otherwise, we're Geeks Without God, and we'll have a new episode up next Tuesday. Haven't missed one yet. Bye.
Bye.
Boner, boner, boner.
So wait, which parts of the body can't get a geeky boner?
My butt.
The spleen.
A pancreas.
You're both wrong.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks. Geeks without God.
Until next time, you can find us blogging and listen to past podcasts at geekswithoutgod.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at geekswithoutgod.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God.
Fuck you for setting us up for failure.